from KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, an energy company encouraging innovation right here in California. This is the power of human energy. Information available at chevroncalifornia.com. The California Healthcare Foundation. Ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. urscorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Rachel Miro in for Scott Schaefer. Coming up, more money and troops are set to arrive on the border with Mexico just ahead of the election in November, but long after the number of people crossing illegally has dropped.
While the Border Patrol says that their beefed up enforcement is preventing people from crossing, deterring them from crossing, the economy in the last few years also plays a huge part in this.
And by the San Francisco Bay, bulldozers help to restore wetlands. They serve as a natural sponge, absorbing sea level surges, and that means local towns below sea level will be a little bit safer from the effects of climate change. That plus a wild musical ride inspired by Babylonia, all in the next half hour. It's the California Report. We begin this week at the U.S.-Mexican border. Federal and state officials met there to talk about a surge of troops from the National Guard starting September 1st. And last week, President Obama signed into law a $600 million bill to pay for 1,500 new border agents, unmanned surveillance drones, and border patrol stations for the entire Southwest. The extra manpower and money is widely seen as a bipartisan response to political unrest in Arizona over illegal immigration. But the boost in border support is not unwelcome. We're joined now by Amy Isaacson, who covers the border for KPBS in San Diego.
There will be 250 National Guard soldiers at California's border. The vast majority of them will be centered in San Diego and focused on enforcement. And this is different to 4 years ago when 1,500 National Guard soldiers came to the border, and they did things more focused on infrastructure, like building fences and roads. So the people who are here now will be stationed at strategic points, according to the Border Patrol, along the border, and they'll act as extra eyes and ears and also as deterrents. They'll patrol in Border Patrol vehicles with Border Patrol logos, yet it will be National Guard soldiers inside. They'll be armed. However, they have direction to do everything that they can to avoid shooting. And also, they'll be stationed on San Diego beaches north through Camp Pendleton, which is the Marine base here in San Diego, because there have been so many boats smuggling people and drugs that have landed on San Diego beaches here.
There's been an explosion in drug violence south of the border in Mexico. Does any of this money, this troop support, either from the National Guard or on the federal level, have to do with addressing that drug war?
The National Guard is there not just to serve as lookouts for people who are crossing the border illegally to come to the U.S. to work or join their families, but they're also there as lookouts for people who are smuggling drugs. In addition, the $600 million border bill, there's an allocation within that to help train Mexican law enforcement, and that ostensibly is to help them become better police to crack down on the drug trade in Mexico. That said, FBI crime statistics show that some of the safest cities with the lowest rates of violent crime are on the U.S. side of the border, like San Diego and El Paso.
There's been a lot of focus on Arizona, but the story in California is different. Apprehensions are down in a big way.
They are. Here in San Diego, they're actually down 43% this year, according to the Border Patrol. Just by means of comparison, back in 1992, the Border Patrol apprehended 565,000 people trying to cross the border illegally. That compares to last year in 2009, a drop to 118,000. While the Border Patrol says that their beefed up enforcement is preventing people from crossing, deterring them from crossing, the economy in the last few years also plays a huge part in this. When there aren't jobs in the U.S., people don't cross. And based on research done by immigration experts from the University of California, San Diego, in communities where lots of people cross the border, many people say we're waiting until the jobs get better. So I think that we'll have to see how effective this buildup of enforcement is once the economy picks up.
The Bush administration sent troops and money in 2006. Have we learned any lessons that we can apply to the new troop surge?
When the Bush administration sent 1,500 National Guard soldiers to the border in California back in 2006, there was outcry from Mexico about the U.S. militarizing the border. What's interesting is with this surge in National Guard soldiers at the border, and also with this $600 million border security bill that will put 1,500 agents along the border, we haven't heard that same kind of pushback and same kind of concern from Mexico. Interestingly, talking with Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Alan Burson, he said that when you work together like the U.S. and Mexico are, and he says it's historic collaboration, there's the rule of no ambushes. And so he says that the U.S. gave Mexico a heads up on this through ambassadors and through government officials that this is what they were going to do.
There's a big election coming up in November, and even though immigration is a huge issue for many American voters, there's no talk of any kind of comprehensive reform coming between now and November. That said, is local law enforcement happy for this extra support, however limited or temporary it might be?
Border Patrol officials said earlier this week that they're very pleased to have the extra help. They said that they were actually suspicious of the National Guard when they came in 2006, but they saw what a great job they did, and they're happy to have them back on the border. However, if we look back historically, back to 1994, there's been this focus on enforcement from the federal government along the border, and that's really had little effect on controlling illegal immigration. And in some cases, it's actually had unintended deadly consequences with more than 5,000 deaths as people get pushed out of areas and get pushed into areas that are more dangerous to cross. In addition, smuggling prices have gone up. It's become such good business that organized crime has now gotten involved, which has made things more dangerous.
Amy, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Reporter Amy Isaacson of KPBS in San Diego. Illegal immigration is sure to be a hot topic at the California Republican Party Fall Convention in San Diego this weekend. John Myers, our Sacramento bureau chief, will be there, but first he joined us in studio, where he told us Republicans are excited about Meg Whitman's chances to take the governor's seat in November.
The polls have been close. You know, they think that Jerry Brown is vulnerable, a man with 40 years in California politics and a long record, and they've got a candidate who's got an awful lot of money. She spent more than $100 million of her own money so far, and so they're not worried about having the resources to take this fight to the Democrats in the fall. I do think that Whitman has a bit of a challenge this weekend, a little bit of tricky gymnastics, as I would call it. You know, she needs to fire up the base to help her win, to help her get out there and really work the phones and work the precincts over the fall. And yet she's got to keep from cozying up too much to them, in a way that she might be drawn into really some real conservative issues that the core of the party in California believes in, but not necessarily moderate and independent voters. And those are the people that she has to really reach out to because, you know, since the June primary, she's been trying very hard to move to the center a little bit more on certain issues.
Well, she's got trouble along those lines then if one considers that a number of Republicans on the hard right are pushing for bills that may be delicate issues, not just for Meg Whitman, but also Carly Fiorina running for a U.S. Senate seat in California.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of discussion this weekend about some social issues that have been in the news. The first one, of course, is illegal immigration, what to do about it. There's going to be discussion in this convention about perhaps a resolution in favor of the Arizona law dealing with illegal immigration and giving law enforcement those powers in Arizona. Meg Whitman has said that while she thinks the law is good for Arizona, she would not support it for California. That's a difference with the base of the Republican Party, and that's going to be something interesting to watch this weekend. And also there's going to be some discussion about illegal immigration in terms of state services and the old Prop 187 argument from the 1990s. That's another tough one for Whitman. And these could be tough for Carly Fiorina as well, as you said in her campaign with Barbara Boxer, though Fiorina has consistently maintained a more conservative stance about a lot of things.
What do you expect the reception will be for Carly Fiorina?
I think Fiorina's going to get a great reception. You know, she really did well at the earlier convention back in February. This is her audience, and she's probably going to do a great number on Barbara Boxer. I think she'll get a great reception. And then I think other candidates are going to be there, too, so we'll be seeing what kind of reaction they get. Abel Maldonado, who's running for lieutenant governor, is definitely not a person that the base loves. I mean, he voted for a tax increase in the state Senate. They're not thrilled about that, but they would rather have him than Gavin Newsom as lieutenant governor.
Let's talk money. What's the fundraising picture for the GOP this season beyond Meg Whitman and her campaign?
Well, the party needs money, that's for sure. They've got a slate of candidates for statewide offices that they really believe they have a chance with. We've named some of them here. Maldonado for lieutenant governor, Steve Cooley for attorney general. They've got Damon Dunn, a former NFL star, for secretary of state. Tony Strickland for controller, Mimi Walters for treasurer. I could go on and on, but they've got some candidates that they really think are appealing, and they're going to need money for those races. They're going to need money for legislative races as well. Trouble is that so far, when you look at the numbers, the Republicans have been behind the Democrats in terms of party fundraising, and so they've got a lot of work to do. There has been some conversation that Meg Whitman would give the party some money or at least help them with their fundraising, but money is really, really important in getting out the message, and so they've got some work to do.
Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers, ahead of a trip to San Diego this weekend to attend the Republican Party convention. John, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This summer, earth movers on the shores of the San Francisco Bay dug in to start the biggest wetlands restoration project ever in the western U.S. The project is intended to preserve habitat for endangered species, but wetlands are also a key line of defense against rising sea levels. Craig Miller reports as part of our project, Climate Watch.
As John Bourgeois pulls up along the banks of Alviso Slough near the southern end of San Francisco Bay, there's a flock of birds chattering from the flat waters of the South Bay Salt Ponds Restoration Project. It's the largest tidal wetlands restoration on the West Coast, with a footprint bigger than Manhattan. And as project manager for the State Coastal Conservancy, it's sort of Bourgeois' baby. It's low tide, and the receding waters reveal a slab of cement-like earth.
Which is what you're seeing out here now. You're seeing a vast mud flat, and you're not seeing any marsh vegetation.
200 years ago, the bayshore was mostly wetlands. Over time, developers filled much of them in to build for a growing population. Some were walled into ponds for harvesting salt. Eventually, those ponds became too briny for freshwater marsh plants and animals, and now what's left are mudflats so hard they barely absorb water. Kind of like a paved parking lot with no drains, it's a flood waiting to happen. And this puts shoreline communities at risk.
It's always a concern if you have a very high tide at the same time that you have a big storm event. It'll exacerbate the flooding.
Across the bay in Redwood City, proposals to build housing on former salt ponds just like these are under serious consideration. Flooding is a very real danger for the South Bay region, much of which is actually lower than the neighboring wetlands. Back when this was farmland, water was pumped out of the ground for irrigation, and the land began to sink. Some places, like the town of Alviso, are as much as 10 feet below sea level. Mendel Stewart manages wetlands for the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service.
You can stand on a levee in Alviso, just right over there, and you can look on one side and see the community way down there, and you look over here and see the marsh. And it's much higher than the buildings and the structures that are in the community of Alviso right below it.
During the past century, the water level in San Francisco Bay has risen nearly 8 inches. And as ocean temperatures continue to rise, planners are preparing for waters to rise 3 feet or more by the end of this century. Restoration managers say that because wetlands act as a huge sponge absorbing high tides and storm surges, restoring them is vital to protecting the shoreline and its communities from rising sea levels. Restoration starts by moving a lot of dirt. Bulldozers have been busy breaking down barriers that separate the salt ponds and building up levees that'll still be needed. Baywater then rushes into the ponds, and the ensuing tides bring in fresh sediments, which will slowly collect and form the foundation for new wetlands.
The water slows and the sediments drop out. And as it drops out, the base layer, the base muds, the sediments build over time. And as they build, the marsh continues to grow and it builds.
The process takes years. In places too hard and salty for plants to take root, it takes time for the layers of sediment to settle and vegetation to take over.
So the marsh is building and rising at the same time, and hopefully faster, than the water level rise due to climate change.
Stewart said the base height of the wetlands in the South Bay grows about 3 to 4 inches a year, which, so far, has helped it keep pace with higher tides.
You can look out and see there's a lot of sediment out there. It didn't look like this before, but if you get closer to the breaches, you find where the sediment's deeper, and there's already marsh establishment.
While restoring wetlands can help some areas adapt to rising seas, managers say that, especially for low-lying communities, restoration alone will not prevent flooding. To be safe, they say, levees will have to be built in some places. Will Travis is the executive director of the Bay Conservation and Development Commission, which oversees shoreline development in San Francisco Bay. He's explored ideas from as far afield as the Netherlands, looking for ways to cope with rising sea levels, but he agrees that as low-cost, long-term solutions go, it's tough to beat the wetlands that are already there.
Tidal wetlands are about as close to magic as you can get when you're dealing with sea level rise, because all wetlands are wonderful for flood protection.
Close to the water's edge, where there was once a hard-packed mud flat, new sediments support a dense mane of marsh grasses. Nearby, a flock of birds takes flight. It feels like progress, though managers say restoration of the more than 16,000 acres planned could take 30, maybe 50 years, and millions of dollars. For the California Report, I'm Craig Miller.
This story was produced by Climate Watch intern Rachel Cohen. We've got photos of the restoration work online at californiareport.org/climatewatch. You can talk back to us if you want. Tell us what you think of the things you hear on the California Report. Comment on stories at our website, californiareport.org. You can also sign up for our podcast, listen to stories in our archive, and lots more. Again, it's all at californiareport.org. You can find us at iTunes, too. For more than 30 years, the Shakespeare Society of America called the Globe Playhouse in West Hollywood home. Luminaries like Ed Harris, John Ritter, and Annie Potts walked the floorboards at the mini replica of the Globe Theater in England. But a few years back, the Society had to pack up, relocate, and reinvent itself as a museum in Moss Landing. Whether that's been enough to ensure the Society's survival is an open question, as Krista Almanzon reports from KAZU in Pacific Grove.
Terry Taylor stands on the porch of a former antique auction house, resting his arm on a 7-foot-tall tin knight.
As you see, the street out here has got all kinds of industrial traffic.
The new Shakespeare Sanctuary is nestled between an art gallery and antique shop on the main drag in Moss Landing along Highway 1, just south of Santa Cruz. Visitors come here to tour a collection that includes thousands of Shakespeare-related books, countless antiques, and pieces of art and memorabilia.
Right here on the wall, first of all, is a playbill from the 1830s. Next, we have in the cabinet here are what are called Shakespeare's medals. Down below, those are the National Shakespeare editions of the complete works of Shakespeare.
The Shakespeare Society of America has not always called this home. Taylor's uncle, Thad Taylor, founded the organization 35 years ago in West Hollywood and later opened the Globe Playhouse, a scaled replica of Shakespeare's original Globe Theater, where Taylor produced all of Shakespeare's plays. Actor and educator Gary Boland says the Society provided something unique to L.A., where many do stage work in hopes of landing a television or movie gig.
You know, it was a way of exercising the acting muscle without worrying about, gee, is this commercially viable? Is my agent going to like me, you know, doing this? We didn't care. You're doing it because you love doing Shakespeare.
And those who knew Thad say that love of Shakespeare kept the organization alive.
So it always looked to me like a one-man band. This guy just, you know, by dint of his own passion, just sort of willing this Shakespeare organization into existence and into survival.
That's where the society finds itself once again, except now it's Thad's nephew Terry with the will to keep it going. After Thad passed away in 2006, the society lost its lease, so Terry packed up his uncle's extensive Shakespeare collection and moved it to Santa Cruz County. It's where he found affordable storage space and later this former antique auction house, where he opened the new Shakespeare Sanctuary. Elizabethan era music is always playing, and Taylor is always ready to greet visitors.
Where are you all visiting from today?
San Jose.
San Jose, okay.
No longer a stage organization, the Society is now a museum, archive, and educational resource with dreams of growing. One of Taylor's ideas is to create a mobile museum that travels to area schools with a repertory group.
In that case, they could go anywhere. I call that a green cultural arts delivery system. So rather than having a school bus come here with so many kids, we could basically take vehicles out on the road.
When local educator Monica Williams stopped by, she found some books that piqued her interest. She reads from one book suggesting how to use Shakespeare to talk about CPR.
Use the death scene in Romeo and Juliet to motivate a discussion on cardiovascular resuscitation.
She works at the North Monterey County Unified School District.
We're trying to work some arrangement to help him bring Shakespeare into our schools. Budgets are tight right now, but we'd really like to use this wonderful resource in our schools.
The challenge for the Shakespeare Society of America is also financial. Since the move, it's survived on Taylor's full-time dedication, minor donations, and personal loans from the Society's board of directors.
We're right now at about 45 months since we had to throw everything in boxes. We have about $200,000 in debt of carrying it this far, always with the expectation that the angels are going to come through the door, recognize and appreciate the magnitude of what we have here.
Every day he meets people who appreciate the collection, but he hasn't found a financial angel yet. Still, some ideas are panning out. Right now, he's working with the Central Coast Girl Scouts on an educational program. For the California Report, I'm Krista Almanzon in Moss Landing.
The latest work from the San Francisco Bay Area band Charming Hostess is called The Bowls Project. It's not just an album, but an art exhibit inspired by Babylonian Jewish amulets. The Bowls Project attempts to connect us viscerally with people who lived 1,500 years ago in the area we now know as Iraq. It's an innovative idea and one that resonates with our pop music critic Steve Hawkman.
The bass clarinet line that opens The Bowls Project by Charming Hostess could almost be an outtake from Peter and the Wolf. Perhaps a theme for some animal that didn't make Prokofiev's final cut?
I am standing at the shore of the sea, at the shore of the great ocean. To the nighthawk and the birds.
The Birds of the River is the song's title, but half a minute later it sounds like the birds are getting eaten by an alligator.
I adore you, great bird of the river.
And there, in a matter of seconds, you have a hint of the range of this album, though even that won't prepare you for what's to come. After all, this is an album that stretches from ancient Babylonia to Blind Willie Johnson, from heady folk to heavy metal, from hummable charm to dissonant harm. It's an album on which a woman named Julie Eisenberg, and she spells it J-E-W-L-I-A, sings a song originally about Jesus making up a dying bed. Only she doesn't actually sing Jesus, but leaves it less specific. If that makes you think about Led Zeppelin a little, or a lot, it's no accident. This version even includes a prominent musical quote from Zeppelin's 1975 reworking under the title In My Time of Dying. And if that's not enough, the album also includes an interpretation of another Zepp-associated song, Hangman, which, though leaning more to the folk rock side of things, carries a lot of the English band's raw energy.
Oh, hangman,
What does that have to do with inscribed pottery buried by Babylonian Jewish women under their homes 1,500 years ago? See, that's the thread of the Bowles Project, tied to Eisenberg's interactive art installation at San Francisco's Yerba Buena Center. From translations of the Aramaic text and the totemic nature of the decorations, Eisenberg extracted a host of spiritual longings and sensual desires, holding them up as the feminine mirror to the male-heavy Talmudic law that emerged from the same culture. In her musical settings of these words, she on one end of the scale internalizes a sense of distress and anger, notably the very hard-edged despair of the lament bound and turned aside. At other points, Eisenberg and her very accomplished accomplices in Charming Hostess shaped the Jewish incantations and prayers into various forms. With Yavo HaGoel, it's very much drawn on the sounds of the source region. And with a few songs, such as Merduk Bat Benai, she and the band managed to forge all these elements into a new musical language of their own. As such, the Bowles Project is expressions of the musicians' wishes and aspirations, the ones meant to be shared and enjoyed, not buried and lost.
Steve Hochman writes the weekly global music column Around the World for Spinner.com. He reviewed The Bowles Project by Charming Hostess. That's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering by Howard Gelman and Danny Bringer. Thanks to our interns, Kristen Torres, Aaron Ferguson, Catherine Tolentino, Mike Anderson, and Devin Katayama. The producer is Victoria Malione. Gabriel Cohn is our senior online editor. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Rachel Myra. Scott Schaefer returns next week. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities across California. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The SunPower Corporation, online at sunpowersolar.com.